Welcome to episode 14 of Sea Change, the podcast dedicated to telling the stories of amazing women and their accomplishments in their own words. I'm Annie Silas, the host of Sea Change and CEO of R. Silas, a woman-owned financial services firm that is committed to creating more opportunities for women in our industry and in our community. Today's guest is Princeton University professor Nancy Weiss Malkiel, a scholar in 20th century American history, and author most recently and most relevant to today's discussion of the book, Keep the Damned Women Out, The Struggle for Co-Education. During her time at Princeton, she served as dean of the college, responsible for the entirety of the undergraduate academic program. She served as founding master of one of the six residential colleges on campus. She's a trustee of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, just to name a few of her accomplishments. I first came across Professor Malkiel and her work at a conference in October of 2018, where she presented her study on the evolution of coeducation in higher ed. I found the story as fascinating and as relevant to some of today's gender diversity struggles then as I do now. Like so many of my generation, these opportunities that exist at givens were the fight of our mothers in the very recent past. Understanding the nuances of how they were won is vital to breaking down the next barrier, in my opinion. I'm grateful to Professor Malkiel for her work on this topic and even more grateful for her time today. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for being on our podcast, Sea Change. The entire idea behind this podcast is to highlight people who are doing amazing things in their industry, who are disruptors, who are highlighting the achievements of women, and you tick every single one of those boxes. So I'm just thrilled that you had time for us today to share your story, and I'm excited for all of our listeners to learn a little bit more about your journey and about some of the work you've done.
Thank you, Annie. Delighted to be with you.
So there's so much to cover because I definitely want to talk about your book, Keep the Damn Women Out, which is a great name, and discuss everything about the book. But I also want to talk about your own journey and your career because it's equally as impressive and so intertwined with the story of your book. So there's a lot to cover, but let's just dive right in. So you came to Princeton in 1969 as a professor.
That's right.
And you were certainly the first woman professor in the history department there and one of the very few women on the faculty at that time.
That's right. When I came, there were three women in the professorial ranks in the university. There was one woman who was a tenured faculty member in sociology, Suzanne Keller, and she had been tenured the year before. And then there were two of us who were new assistant professors, me in history and Karen Brazel in East Asian studies. And that was it. There were Russian ladies teaching Russian language. They were called the Russian ladies. But that was it in the professorial ranks. And that happened to be the first year that undergraduate women came to Princeton. But when I was hired, the winter, late fall before, no one knew that would be the case.
So that, I mean, I think that's one of the most fascinating things is just how your story runs parallel to the story of your book and co-education at Princeton and other elite universities that you showed up on campus that same year. And you were quite young, early 20s, right?
Oh, yeah. I was 25 when I got here. A lot older than my students.
Right, which is amazing. And tell me a little bit about how you came to the job at Princeton. You had been in a master's program at Harvard.
I was in a PhD program in American history at Harvard or in history. And that fall, this was the fall of 1968, I was a teaching fellow at Harvard in Harvard's first African-American studies course. There were a number of faculty members teaching that course, but the faculty member leading it was my thesis advisor, Frank Friedel, the biographer of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And so Frank asked me if I would be a teaching fellow for this course called SOCSI-5. And I had been in Washington. I had gone to Washington after I completed my general exams in the spring of 1967. And I had gone there to research my dissertation. And I was writing a history of the National Urban League, whose papers were in the Library of Congress. And so when Frank asked me to come back to Cambridge, be a teaching fellow in Sauk Sci 5, I figured that was a good idea. I would get some teaching experience. I actually believed at that point that I wouldn't be very good at it and I wouldn't like it very much. So this was sort of proof of concept to go back. And one day Frank came to class to lecture and he said, I've recommended you for a job at. And we both laughed because there were no women at Princeton. And he said it would be good for them to have to. Now, the way hiring was done then, people did not advertise jobs. Institutions did not advertise jobs. There weren't applications for jobs. The faculty member doing a search in American history at Princeton would call his friends at Harvard and Yale and a couple other places and say, essentially, who have you got? And since I was both in 20th century American history and writing a dissertation in African American history, and that fit with what Princeton was looking for, Frank Friedel recommended me to Princeton. So I was invited for an interview. I'd only completed two chapters of my dissertation. I was not looking for a job, but I figured, hey, you're invited for an interview at Princeton, you show up. So my grandmother at that time was living in northern New Jersey. I went to her apartment. I picked up her car and drove down to Princeton. I had never been to Princeton before. It was a gray and rainy day, and I parked in front of Alexander Hall, and as I had been instructed to do, walked over to the history department in Dickinson Hall. And no sooner was I seated in the office of the department chair, Lawrence Stone, than the department manager knocked on the door and said, public safety called, you left the lights on in your car. So I had to leave the chair's office, go over and turn my lights off. Not exactly the most auspicious way to begin. So Lawrence Stone, who was a quite formidable scholar of early modern British history, English history, really, told me that it wasn't that Princeton had a policy against hiring women. It was that no one had ever suggested it before. So I spent the day with the department, and what I did not know then, but came to know soon thereafter, is that mostly when you're hiring a new assistant professor, the search committee of faculty has a really hard time getting other faculty to pay attention to the candidates. And so you take the candidate into the department lounge and the members of the search committee sit there hoping against hope that some faculty member will come in to talk to the candidate. Well, the department lounge was full. Me that afternoon. Everybody came because they had never seen one like me, and they were intensely curious to know what I was about. So the medieval historian and the historian of Africa, and you name it, they all showed up for a long and engaged conversation. At the same time, I had lunch with all the American history faculty members. And again, you know, getting everybody to show up for something like that is well nigh impossible, but they certainly wanted to know what I was about. And we had a very lively conversation. There was no book talk. You know, what's normal now if you're applying for a job is you give a book talk to the faculty and graduate students in the department. There was no such thing then. So I talked about my dissertation at lunch. I talked about the teaching I was doing. I answered questions in the lounge. And then I went back to Cambridge. And I was offered the job. And I figured, why not? That looks like a nice place. Might as well. I wasn't at all sure that I was going to make a long-term commitment to teaching and scholarship. That was not something I would appropriately have said out loud to my new colleagues, but I figured I'd gone to graduate school because my undergraduate thesis advisor at Smith College had told me that I should go to graduate school, that I should go to Harvard. He had nominated me for a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. And I figured, okay, if you like reading history, you're reasonably good at it, you might as well go to graduate school, do more of it. But I thought there were a lot of things I could do with a PhD. I had worked for a summer as an intern at the Washington Post while I was in graduate school. I thought maybe I could be a newspaper reporter or work for a magazine. I had worked for two summers for Peter Rodino, the congressman from Newark, who was later much made famous by the Watergate hearings, but then wasn't at all famous. And I thought maybe I could go back to work on Capitol Hill. So I thought there were a lot of possibilities. I had discovered, by the way, that I liked teaching when I was teaching for Frank Friedel and Sauk Sci Five. So that was not out of the question. So I arrived at Princeton. And everybody knew who I was, the president of the university, the provost, the dean of the faculty. It was inevitable. There were so few of us that everybody knew who we were. My students, who were at that point all male, when I would go into precept, you know, the Princeton name, as you know, for discussion classes. All these very conservatively dressed young men around the table would stand up and pull my chair out for me. One of my junior advisees brought me an apple to office hours. In my course evaluations, I got comments like, you teach from a feminine point of view. There's less idle joking in your classes. I asked some of the students I knew best what that meant, and they didn't know. They thought they were sort of embarrassed. I got invited to eating clubs for meals. And what would invariably happen was that we'd be sitting around the table having a perfectly plausible conversation at dinner, and it'd be quite far into the meal before the students other than my students at the table would realize that I was a faculty member, not a not somebody's date, because, as I say, I was 25 years old. They were 21, maybe 22.
What was the experience of all of that like for you in terms of how much did it factor in for you taking the position and being aware that you were going to be one of few, if not the only? I mean, I imagine coming from Harvard, you couldn't have been, you know, in the majority, working at something like an internship at the Washington Post or for Congress. I mean, it sounds like you were not intimidated by a setting where you were going to be one of few.
Yeah, I was not. And I attribute that, frankly, to my experience at Smith, where I had the opportunity to be much involved in campus life as well as things academic. I edited the newspaper at Smith and was one of the officers of student government. So I got to sit with the president and the deans on a weekly basis and see up close how an academic institution worked. So that, plus the fact that this is a women's college, gave me a lot of strength, if you will, and self-confidence. quite honestly, I never thought very much about, my goodness, you are going to be one of the few women in a historically male university that's co-educating. That is worth pondering. I honestly didn't. I was naive enough not to have thought. I just lived it rather than thought about it. Right. And so, for example, I was invited, you know, by the provost, by the dean of the faculty, by the president, to serve on all sorts of committees, to give all sorts of talks. And it's obvious they wanted one of the three of us. And I could have regarded that as tokenism and been offended. I thought it was a good way to learn the university before I would have otherwise. And if there were things I did that I liked, I could do them again. And if I didn't like them, I didn't have to. I got invited to lunch and dinner by my colleagues in the department all the time. I had no idea that that was atypical for a new assistant professor. They wanted to find out what I was about. I thought they wanted to be friends. And so the mode of socializing in those days was dinner parties for 12 people on Saturday night at 7:30. So I invited faculty members, senior faculty members and their wives back to dinner at my apartment for dinner parties. Now, I was pretty naive. I thought they just meant to be friends. Right. So in lots of ways, I had a better time than I would have if I had been your run-of-the-mill male assistant professor, even though we know for sure that a number of those faculty members didn't think I belonged there. And I know for sure that the women faculty members who followed me in subsequent years in other departments had a way more difficult time than I did. My colleagues maintained a basic civility, politeness. So I didn't have to deal with the nastiness and the disparagement most of the time. I did some of the time, but...
And what about, did you get backlash from students? Was there sort of a, I don't want to take a class from a woman?
Not really. Really. I know there were students who believed that, but...
You didn't feel it.
I have a very large number of male students. I taught 20th century American political history. My senior colleague, Arthur Link, the biographer of Woodrow Wilson, had for many years offered a 20th century American political history course, and he was giving it for the last time. And the deal was that I would give a half dozen of the lectures, and if I would teach, as it turned out, they weren't precepts, they were 25 student sections, five of them. And if I did all right, he would give me the course after a year. So I had male students in very, very, very large numbers.
And did people associate your hiring with this co-education backdrop and sort of link the two? Like, this is what they're doing now. School's going co-ed. They're going to try to hire more women.
Absolutely.
Interesting. And so did you feel... kind of like a camaraderie with all the women who were showing up on campus at the first time? Did you feel like a responsibility or a role within that?
I got to know them early on, whether in the classroom or not. They told me stories about what it was like to be in that first year the class of 73 especially, but the women who came as transfer students. You know, stories like what I tell in the book about faculty members not taking them seriously, about fellow students, male students, making disparaging comments about them, about sitting home dateless on Saturday night when the ratio was such that they should have had, you know, each should have had a half dozen dates for Saturday night. And what they said was that male students said they didn't want to risk asking because they didn't want to be turned down. And so they didn't ask. So the women at home, talking to each other, whereas the men thought that they were all dated up. So I heard a lot about the experience of the women students. And then I began getting to know women in academic settings as my junior advisees, as my senior thesis advisees. Before long, I was teaching women's history. Now, I knew nothing about women's history. I worked in Black history. And the American Studies program gave what they called conferences and seminars that were required for certificate students. And so I had a couple times around taught Blacks in America with several colleagues in history and in English. They had done socialism, they had done other things. And the faculty program committee said, so the next subject we're going to do is women in America, and you're the logical person to teach it. Now, there was a woman faculty member coming in the English department, Ann Douglas Wood, who knew something about this. So the idea was that she and I would teach this together. And I said to my fellow faculty members on the program committee, I don't know anything about women's history. And their answer was, yes, but you're the logical person. So when I started teaching women's history for a while, of course, I got to know other women students that way.
And so this is an interesting place to kind of to pivot back to your book, which it kind of chronicles the entire journey of these elite educational institutions with Princeton and Yale front and center in so many ways on this idea of going co-ed and all the forces that went into that and all the decision making process and then the experience of it. So I'd love to just take a moment and talk a little bit about, you know, the forces that led up to that decision. And obviously there was this enormous social unrest backdrop going on in the country at that time. But what's interesting about your work is this idea that it was really something that made a lot of sense for the institution and their ability to maintain this elite educational status, almost like a good for business rather than a decision about what was morally correct and wanting to provide this opportunity for women. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what you found the lead up to this decision and the factors and how it came to be at that time?
Sure. I had thought when I set out on this project that I was going to write a history of coeducation at Princeton, set in a larger context. And I discovered as I went along that there was a much more interesting question. And that was why so many elite, formerly all male institutions admitted women all at once, both in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And so I changed the scope of the book. Now, the 60s obviously mattered here. The civil rights movement, the student movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, going to school by the late 1960s was a way different experience than it had been in the early 1960s. And the notion that you would join in these protest movements together with women, with men, and then go your separate ways when you went back to school seemed increasingly hard to credit. What was most important in terms of motivating these institutions was that they began to lose a number of the best applicants, boys who wanted to go to school with girls. Princeton and Yale called them the best boys, and they were accustomed to drawing their share of the best boys in admissions each year. And what started to happen by the latter part of the 1960s was that they weren't drawing their fair share of the best boys. Up until, say, the middle of the 1960s, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton essentially went head-to-head in admissions, drawing, essentially dividing the pie on these best boys. And what started happening in the late 1960s is that the best boys wanted to go to school with girls, and so Harvard began pulling away from Princeton and Yale in the competition. Now, Harvard was not co-ed, of course, but Radcliffe was up the street, and their classes were co-ed, and increasingly by the 1970s, their extracurricular activities and even their living circumstances were co-ed. So Princeton and Yale essentially said to themselves, this is not going to do. No, we're not accustomed to needing to scramble to catch up here. Yale and Princeton were in direct competition with each other throughout this saga. Neither one wanted the other one to steal a march and go co-ed and leave the school behind. So first of all, Kingman Brewster, the president of Yale, pursued the possibility of hooking up with Vassar College. Vassar was in Poughkeepsie. Vassar at that point was a women's college. Vassar was having trouble with applicants. It just seemed like possibly a natural marriage. And so for the better part of a year, Vassar and Yale seriously studied the possibility of a merger. Now, while Vassar and Yale were talking, Robert Goheen, the president of Princeton, thought, can't let this happen. And Goheen went up to Sarah Lawrence College, then a women's college in Bronxville, to talk to the president about possibly bringing Sarah Lawrence to Princeton, maybe on an adjacent plot of land, maybe as a coordinate college, not clear. Well, no, what an unlikely marriage that probably would have been. So that didn't work out. Sarah Lawrence essentially said, you are way more conservative than we are. And if we hook up with you, we're going to lose what makes us distinctive. So no, thank you. So the possibility of something happening in New Haven led Goheen to decide to ask the trustees to authorize a study of the desirability and feasibility of coeducation at Princeton. Now, he didn't think coeducation was a very good idea, and he was very reluctant. But his new provost, William G. Bowen, young economics professor, who would turn out to be his successor, his new provost thought coeducation was essential for Princeton's future. So they agreed that, however it came out, what they needed was a serious research project with data and analysis. And if the trustees were to be persuaded, that's what it would take. So they engaged Gardner Patterson, an economist on the faculty, what was then the Woodrow Wilson School, to do this study. And Patterson did serious research on, first of all, whether there was, if you will, a market. Were there women who would want to come to Princeton? What would they study? How would it work? What would we need to do by way of additional faculty members? What would we need to do in terms of housing? And he also studied the way coeducation and coordinated education had worked at other institutions. Stanford was the best example for them of how coeducation could work. Coordinate education, Pembroke and Brown, before Brown absorbed Pembroke and became co-ed. So Patterson did serious work. And while Patterson was working, not much was going on in New Haven. Kingman Brewster, after Vassar came a Cropper, said, well, you know, there are a lot of things we could do here. We could establish our own women's college. We could establish programs for women that aren't a liberal arts college, but are co-ed programs. So for many months, Brewster essentially wrote papers himself about what coeducation could look like at Yale, but nothing was going on. So then in September of 1967, Gardner Patterson, September of 1968, Gardner Patterson's study on the desirability and feasibility of coeducation at Princeton is completed and is distributed to all Princeton alumni and to every other educational institution. And a copy lands in New Haven, and Kingman Brewster reads it and decides that Princeton could actually be serious about coeducation and decides that there isn't a way in the world that Yale is going to let that happen first. And so between September and November, with no process and no planning, Brewster gets the Yale faculty and the Yale Corporation, their trustees, to vote for coeducation effective in the fall of 1969. Well, Princeton at that point is going through a very process-driven Princeton-style consideration of the report, where the provost and deans and faculty members and students fan out across the country talking to groups of Princeton alumni about the Patterson report, about the prospects for coeducation, about what these alumni think. And all of that, of course, gets reported back to the Board of Trustees. So in January of 1969, when in New Haven, they're reading applications from women students for the entering class the next fall and for transfers, the Princeton trustees decide in principle that they will support coeducation, and they invite Bob Goheen to come back when he's ready and tell them how he would do it. So this is January of 19. He comes back to the trustees meeting at the end of April in 1969. Now, Princeton, in the meantime, had been accepting applications from women students in the event that they decided to admit women. So a Princeton-style decision in April of 1969 would have been to say, yes, we're going to go co-ed. We're going to do it for the fall of 1970. We got a lot of stuff to plan. But they couldn't do that because Yale was admitting women for the fall of 69. So at the very end of April 1969, the Princeton admission dean goes into that trustee weekend with two sets of letters to the women applicants. One set says, sorry, we're not going co-ed yet, try again. The other set says, happy to welcome you.
Wow.
In the fall of 1969. As un-Princeton a move as you could imagine. And so Princeton and Yale really are the protagonists here. Harvard is in a funny position because Harvard is engaged in serious discussions with Radcliffe about a merger, and those break down for a variety of reasons. Harvard doesn't go co-ed, absorbing Radcliffe, until the 1990s. So Harvard is an important factor, but it's really Princeton and Yale leading the pack. And then everybody else is watching Princeton and Yale, the liberal arts colleges, the Catholic universities, other Ivies, and all of it in a very short space of time, within 4 years, there's this flood of decisions for co-education, partly because it seems in the self-interest of these institutions, actually mainly, there isn't a hint in anything I've found. There isn't a hint of altruism. There isn't a hint of we really have a moral responsibility to women as well as to men. We can deliver better education than the women's colleges. Also, what's going on? It will be good for us. We will regain our hold on the best boys if we admit women students.
So I'm really interested in your perspective because sort of fast forward, 20, 25 years later, and you're at Princeton when the lawsuit occurs to force the last couple of Eden clubs to go co-ed. And I think that decision was either enforced or made in around 1991, if I'm not mistaken. What was your perspective watching that unfold? Because now we're talking about, the 1990s. And full disclosure, I got to Princeton in 1996. I ended up being in Tiger Inn, which was one of the last Eden clubs to go co-ed. I arrived kind of 5 years later, and I very candidly had the experience of not even being aware that they ever weren't co-ed. Like, that was sort of news to me because it was so much a given, right? That was never my frame of reference, that experience had been very, very recently off limits to women. So that's sort of an interesting sort of, at my age now, reflecting back on the fact that I was that sort of unaware of how recently that had been fought for. But I wonder, from your perspective, having been there when the university was first going co-ed and then watching this entire thing unfold again, what your thoughts were on that and how you think about, how all of that transpired.
We have a son and daughter-in-law who were in Tiger Inn, daughter-in-law class of 94, son class of 95. As dean, I saw up close some of the, out on the outer edge behaviors that Tiger Inn. I frankly said to myself repeatedly, why would a woman want to be part of it?
I think I heard that from my parents as well.
I had students in the early 1980s whom I knew very well, who were leaders at Ivy Cottage, TI, who were trying to move their peers to affirmative support for co-education. And at least once, one of my students who was president of Ivy asked me to come to dinner and be present while he tried to talk to his fellow students about why co-education. And I was surprised, perhaps, at least bemused by the intensity of the commitment to a single-sex experience at some of those clubs, that somehow you would spoil the specialness of the bonding experience that these male students had at Princeton and that then infused the rest of their lives. If you made them eat and socialize with women. So I found all of that quite striking. It was sort of like the last vestige of the old Princeton. For students in the classes of the early 70s, for many of them, coeducation was sort of an unwelcome trick, which is to say, they applied to an all-male Princeton, they came to an all-male Princeton. In the most extreme case, they went through 3 years of an all-male Princeton, and all of a sudden, Princeton was different. And a lot of those students didn't want Princeton to be different. And I think that the students in Ivy and TI and Cottage were sort of the furthest fringe of the, we want to hold on to what we treasure and value about the old Princeton. And you may be making us go to class with women. You may even be making us live in dormitories with women, but you're not going to make us let women into our sanctuaries.
And it's interesting because that resolution towards co-ed came in a much more, and I hate to use this word, but it was a much more sort of extreme or a forceful way because it was a lawsuit. It wasn't that they sort of came to see the light on co-ed.
Exactly. Which just tells you how tenaciously some of those students held on to what they could preserve.
Right. And it does make me reflect on the, you know, that 69 class and the subsequent classes as women started to build towards critical mass and equal representation physically. And it's something that we talk about a lot in this industry and in finance, but, you know, that is still a far cry from, you know, equality or inclusion of the experience.
Absolutely.
And it's just striking how long that process does, in fact, take.
You know, integrating men and women in the same institution, whether it's a university or a financial firm or the Supreme Court of the United States or you name it, is hard to do. We're still dealing with not growing pains, but with adjustment pains. You know, there was a moment in the early 2000s, early mid first decade of the 21st century, when Shirley Tilghman was the president of Princeton, Amy Gutman was the provost of Princeton, Anne Marie Slaughter was the dean of what was then the Woodrow Wilson School. Maria Clave was the dean of the School of Engineering. I had been already the dean of the college in an undergraduate organization called the Organization of Women Leaders. Had a forum in McCosh 10, a 400-person lecture hall, and they had a panel. Me and Shirley and Anne Marie and Maria. And Shirley had just appointed Janet Rapoli as Dean of Admission, who had been Dean of Admission at Wellesley for goodness sakes. Little challenging for some Princetonians. And a student stood up and said to President Tilghman, "Why did you appoint a woman dean of admission?" And she said, "Because she was the most qualified candidate." And the student persisted and said, "But why do you appoint so many women senior administrators?" And I said, "Wait a minute. The undergraduate student population here is approaching 50-50. And why is that okay, but not okay, to have half of the senior officers of the university be women? And the answer was, it's so embarrassing to have to explain to our fellow students who are male that there's another senior woman been appointed to the president's cabinet. And I thought, you have got to be kidding. No, this is the 21st century. You're going to school at a co-ed institution with women students, and you think it's strange to have a woman appointed dean of admission? So these things, as I say, these things are hard to accomplish. It cannot be, I don't know, but it cannot be that there are a great many firms in the investment industry that are headed by women. Maybe there are, but my guess is that what you're doing is pretty unusual. So why is it hard to do these things? Why is it hard to elect women to the United States Senate, women governors of the various social changes? Really, really hard. And when it's embedded in something as fundamental as gender relationships, it's very hard.
What do you think about the current climate and how it relates to what you've seen in your studies over time and your experience of writing this book and looking at this issue? And specifically, I'm wondering how you feel about the recent decision about affirmative action and even, you know, surrounding conversations around legacy and how those things affect the culture of a university.
You know, I used to believe, as an historian of modern America, that we were making incremental progress as a society, not necessarily linear, not nearly as fast as I would like. But if I looked over time at what had been accomplished in terms of race, gender, opportunity, I thought, we're doing better as a society. And what has been stunning to me, and I should have known better, what has been stunning to me is how much of all of that has been rolled back. And I know for sure that progress is not linear and that we take steps back before we can go forward again. But it certainly is discouraging to see. And so the decisions about the Dobbs case, the affirmative action case, I find that sort of thing just profoundly troubling, profoundly disappointing in terms of what it does to restrict opportunity in the society, what it does to make progress for minorities, women on many fronts, to make it more difficult. So how far back are we rolling? I don't know yet, but I certainly don't like much of anything that I'm seeing in our national political life. And where will we go and how long before we start moving forward again? I don't know, but for a place like Princeton, it makes all the difference in the world to have men and women going to school together, to have blacks and whites and Asians and Latinos, you name it. It makes all the difference in the world. One, I really believe in diverse perspectives and experiences, and I've seen it in my own classrooms. You learn better if you're listening to people who are different from you than if you're only listening to people who are the same. In terms of producing leadership for this society, we have an obligation as an institution to do that. And leadership doesn't just come in the form of white, male, Christian, evangelical, you name it. Middle class, upper middle class leadership has got to come from people of both genders. Well, I suppose I'd throw in transgender as well now. From people who are Black and Latino, and you name it. Bill Bowen and Jared Bach, the previous president, a previous president of Harvard, demonstrated conclusively in their book, The Shape of the River, that affirmative action worked. It worked to produce a Black middle class that took its place in the professions, in civic organizations, and made a huge difference in the military, huge difference in terms of the diversity of our leadership. A diverse society, which we are no matter what, can't function without leaders who look like that society and whose own experience represents the experience of that society. And so I think Princeton as an institution needs, as do so many of these universities, to figure out how to make the lived experience of applicants come alive in ways that allow us to admit diverse groups of students, even though we're not counting by racial classifications. We need to do that to enrich the education we offer and to take our responsibility as contributing to the leadership of the society seriously.
Yeah, I think that's so well said, and thank you for sharing your thoughts on that. I know it's a tough topic. So I know I've taken up so much more of your time than I intended to, so I appreciate that. But before we go, I just wondered if you could share just 2 minutes on your upcoming new book that I think fits so nicely into this conversation and will be so interesting when it's out.
I've written a biography of William G. Bowen. He was a professor of economics at Princeton and Bob Goheen's provost, then in 1972 became president of Princeton and served till 1988, whereupon he went to the Andrew Mellon Foundation, stayed there for 18 years. He wrote 20 books, most of them in American higher education, and he pioneered all sorts of initiatives to, if you will, modernize Princeton, make it more diverse and more welcoming to a broader range of students. At Mellon, all sorts of initiatives to try to do for higher education broadly what he was trying to do at Princeton. Two examples, JSTOR, the Electronic Journal Storage Project, where you can now do research in scholarly journals from your own computer. You don't have to go to the library. You don't have to pull those volumes off the shelf. Revolutionizes scholarship, especially in places around the world that don't have runs of scholarly journals. The Mellon Mays Undergraduate Fellowship Program that takes college sophomores, usually sophomores of color or who have a particular interest in diversity but are white, prepares them in various ways to go to graduate school and earn PhDs and then to move into the academy. A significant fraction of the faculty members and senior administrators of color in the academy today got their start with an MMUF fellowship because of what Bowen did. So in my view, he's the most important leader in American higher education in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. My book, which is called Changing the Game, William G. Bowen and the Challenges of American Higher Education, will come out in November from Princeton University Press.
We're so excited about that. And I can't thank you enough for that work for Keep the Damn Women Out. I think what you said about just living in this time when we're seeing so many things roll back, I think it's so important to focus on how recent some of these breakthroughs really were and how fragile and how many different competing voices there are at the table and how people are thinking about things. I think it's more relevant than ever. So thank you for your work and thank you for taking the time today to share it with us.
Thank you, Annie, and very well said about why this is important stuff.
Yes, well, I'm going to be back to talk to you about your new book when it's out. So
yeah. Thanks so much.
Great speaking with you. Fun. Thanks again.
Well, bye-bye.